Happy Leap Day. February 29th only comes around once every 4 years, so we're celebrating today with some science.
Gemma Tarlak is back with us to explain why we have Leap Day, and she's going to share some other cool science news along the way. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello. Happy Leap Day to you both.
Well, it's a fun holiday. Of course, we're exhausted from all of our Leap Day celebrations here, Gemma. But what's the reason for the day? Why do we have Leap Day?
Well, it's, you know, the universe is just really sometimes inconvenient for us puny humans, basically. Now, obviously, the Earth's rotation takes 24 hours. We, you know, figured that out, divided the day into 24 hours, and that works out great for us. However, the Earth does not take an even amount of days to go around the sun. It takes 365.2422. There's that little bit extra. So over time, that little bit extra builds up, and every 4 years, we have about 0.97 extra of a day because of that, because the going around the sun doesn't equal an exact number of days. So they add that extra day on. One of the things I think is interesting is it's not a full day. It's that, like, 0.97 of a day. So that means that one rule you may not be familiar with, and this has been going around now for centuries, it's leap year every year that is divisible by 4, except for years that are both divisible by 100 but not divisible by 400. So what? I know your head.
And who came up with that?
Well, it's the way we even out the fact that we build up a 0.97 of a day, but we take a whole day every leap day. We add a whole day to the calendar when we're really only 0.97 of a day in deficit, if that makes any sense. So basically, the year 2000 was a leap year, but the year 1700, 1800, and even 1900 were not leap years. And that's how we make up for the fact that we're adding a whole day every 4 years, even though we've accumulated only like 0.97 of a day.
I don't know, Gemma. It sounds kind of Byzantine. Why can't we just forget leap days and just keep going and pretend we don't know about the 0.97?
Well, because pretty soon you're going to have like February and it's going to be like 50-some degrees and, oh, no, wait.
But wait a minute. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, over time we would get more and more off. And then, you know, we'd have to be around for a while, and maybe it would be like, you know, I don't know, our insect overlords or whoever is in charge in 10,000 years. But, you know, over time, things would get really off if you're still dividing things by the seasons. And, you know, the fact is I lived in the Southern Hemisphere for a while. So to me, it's, you know, yeah, sure, December is summer. So I'd like completely abandoned seasons. But, yes, to keep kind of everything on track, we just do that. We add a full day until we build up all that time, and then we just don't have a leap year.
Well, before we move on, the obvious solution, it seems to me, is to slow down the Earth, right? We just get some, you know, super rocket ships that are beyond our current human capacity, push the other way, and to slow that orbit down so it's exactly, you know, the days and the years line up, right?
It's almost too easy.
Explain to me the flaw in my thinking here.
Yeah, I think that would cause some other big problems
that
we don't even want to get into.
Huh. That's an interesting thought, though, Rob. You should run with that.
Yeah. In my future career as a crazed supervillain, I am all over that.
Yeah, email NASA. Let me know how that works out for you.
I think it's time to move on.
I think probably, yeah.
There's nowhere to go with that. So, Gemma, there's some new genetic studies about the first Americans that have caused kind of a stir. What do the studies say?
Yeah, this is a really interesting thing, and it's interesting for a number of reasons. You know, because we don't have any historical record from who and when settled the Americas first, all kinds of crazy ideas have come up. Some of them make a lot of sense. Some of them do not. My favorite one was, like, people kayaking over from France. It's like, no, that did not happen. But what they have, they've done some genetic studies now, because we have enough ancient genomes sequenced that we can compare them to each other, to current Native Americans, and we can really start to see the relationships and understand who is related to who, when all this genetic drift, this kind of natural background of mutations that happens in our DNA that becomes kind of a clock to tell us when certain events happen, we can really kind of get a much better picture. And they're finding out that, yes, First Americans, Native Americans, they are all descended from a group of people who came over the Beringian land bridge. They arrived there from Siberia about 23,000 years ago, and then they moved on when the ice melted enough to keep going eastward, basically, into the Americas, and that was probably about 15,000 years ago. So this genetic study really confirmed what most archaeologists and anthropologists had thought, but we can now definitively point to the DNA and say, yes, you could see it written in the genes of Native Americans that they are related to a wave of immigration that came over from Siberia into the Americas, arriving about 15,000 years ago and then spreading south and eastward. What's really interesting is that there's a separate genetic study that came out that found in South America, there are groups of indigenous people who have a very unique genetic signature, and the only other people in the world who have that signature are found in places like Australia, in Indonesia, and there's one tiny island in Southeast Asia. And we're trying to figure out how those genes got all the way across the Pacific, because if they had been just, you know, boating across the Pacific, if that's how you want to think of it, we would have seen that signature in between, like, Australia and South America. We would be seeing it in the Pacific Islands. Mm. And the fact that it's not there suggests that they came up through Siberia with that other major wave.
And is this
are you still there, or are you doing the leap year math there?
This part of what we discovered from Siberia, that these mystery genes, these genes from Australia and that neighborhood, were present in Siberia, so they could have come over the land bridge then? They didn't have to come across the ocean?
Right, because if they came across the ocean, we should see that genetic signature showing up in places like Tahiti and Fiji, and we don't see it anywhere else. So they're thinking that Australia and Indonesia and Southeast Asia, these little pockets where this genetic signature exists, they actually came up through Siberia. And, you know, it may sound a little bit crazy, but when you actually look at these ancient genetic signatures that they're looking at, for example, they found that there's a 24,000-year-old genome of a young boy from Siberia, and they found specific genetic signatures there that are associated with Europeans today. So that tells us that the folks in Siberia were a lot more cosmopolitan. Mm. They, you know, they probably traveled more widely, interacted with larger groups of people than we had originally thought.
So is this one pretty much put to bed, or what needs to be filled in for this to be pretty solid?
Well, you know, the great thing about science is nothing is ever really 100% put to bed, because, of course, now you have scientists looking at these studies, trying to replicate them, looking at the methodology, and that's how science works. You know, it's always asking the question, can you prove this, and then can I disprove this? So right now, this is about as certain as you can get in science, but, you know, good scientists never definitively say, yes, we have come to the conclusion, we have solved this. Because there's always room to improve upon a theory.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine about some of the latest science news. And Gemma, 100th birthday of the National Park Service this year. And you pointed us toward an unknown fact about national parks. They serve as, in a way, outdoor laboratories for scientists. What kind of things are we seeing in national parks that are helping advance science?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of us think of national parks as this incredible resource, scenic beauty, vacation destination, a way to get out into the outdoors. But the fact is, when this land was set aside, it was set aside and really created like these very precious time capsules. And just for example, when you look at geysers, did you know half of the geysers in the world have been destroyed for one reason or another? But we can still go to Yellowstone and scientists can still study the geysers there because they've been in this protected environment. And that's true. There's so many different projects going on, so many different long-running experiments. Just for example, they're looking at things like, you know, the Everglades in Florida. They have really been under tremendous stress from developers kind of taking their water away. So now they're looking at ways to restore that natural, what they call a river of grass, the natural flow of the water, which has really been massively compromised due to development. And they're looking at things like in New York, there's a national seashore called Fire Island. And they can look at the dunes there and follow and track how those dunes evolve and compare their evolution when something like Superstorm Sandy comes through. They can look at that and learn a lot about how sand dunes form, how they protect coastal areas, and they can take that and apply that to areas that, you know, you might have a vacation home in, or you might be living in, and they might actually be able to protect you and your home better just because of what they have learned from the National Seashore at Fire Island. And there are just hundreds of these experiments all over, from, you know, Alaska all the way down through the Everglades. So it's just really a fascinating and wonderful thing. You know, it's not just a pretty picture when you go to a national park. There are long-running science experiments that are crucial.
Yeah, we think about the parks as, I guess, examples of conservation and preservation, but should we also be being more aware of the science that's going on there and the importance of that in these ecosystems?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're super precious. And if I could get on my soapbox for a minute, you know, a lot of times I love going to national parks, and a lot of times you see those signs, please stay on the trail, please do this, please do that. You know, those signs are not there to be, you know, I don't know, like a third grade teacher slapping you on the wrist if you're naughty. Those signs are there because you can actually jeopardize very fragile ecosystems that we don't have anywhere else anymore.
And are scientists publishing a lot of material based on what goes on in national parks?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And a lot of these things especially are very long-running experiments. Some of them are a single season. Some of them are ongoing. You know, there's this one wonderful experiment currently going on in the Southern California and Nevada area where they are basically replicating a count of species that was done 100 years ago. So it's just tremendous the amount of data that are sitting in our national parks that we just can't find elsewhere. And, you know, they're real-world applications, especially with climate change. We're learning how to protect all of our country better just by the resources that we have in our national parks.
Fascinating stuff. Well, Gemma, thanks. And I assume our leap year presents are on their way in the mail.
You know, yeah.
we'll wait for the next 400-year cycle, I guess.
Exactly.
Well, Gemma, thanks a lot. As always, that was Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha.